Welcome to your weekly Constitutional, a radio show where we discuss something that affects you every day, the United States Constitution. My name is Stuart Harris, and I teach constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in beautiful Grundy, Virginia. And I'm speaking to you today from WETS-FM in Johnson City, Tennessee. Today, we're going to talk about a mysterious subject, a subject of great local but also constitutional interest. We're going to talk about the lost state of Franklin. Now, if you live anywhere near Johnson City, Tennessee, where I'm sitting today, you may have driven upon State of Franklin Road. What is the State of Franklin? We're going to talk all about that today. And we're going to, I'm not going to give it away. You're just going to have to wait to find out what it was, but I will give you this hint. It has to do with how states join the Union. There's our constitutional issue, how states join the Union. And it turns out that this lost state of Franklin had a great deal to do with the particular part of the Constitution that deals with that issue. Later on, we'll be talking to Professor Kevin Barksdale, who is a professor of American history and a specialist in Appalachian and West Virginia history. But right now, we're going to turn to my student, Brad Blanchard of the Appalachian School of Law, and we're going to ask him, Brad, what does the Constitution have to say about how a new state is created?
Well, the most relevant portion is going to be Article 4, Section 3. Which says, new states may be admitted by the Congress into this Union, but no new state shall be formed or erected within the jurisdiction of any other state, nor any state be formed by the junction of two or more states or parts of states without the consent of the legislatures of the states concerned as well as of the Congress.
Well, that's a mouthful. Now, if I just to go over it again briefly and in plain English, it sounds like if you want to be a new state, ultimately Congress has to let you, has to agree, right?
That is correct.
But then there are all these restrictions that crop up if you are part of a current state or if you want to make a state out of parts of more than one state.
That is correct.
And generally speaking, Article 4, Section 2 requires
Section
the consent.
3.
Excuse me. Article 4, Section 3 requires not only the consent of Congress then, but the consent of the states or states involved.
Yes. And that's because they were concerned about keeping the power between the large states and the small states. So the compromise came up with Section 3 because they were concerned both about junction and about separation.
Yeah, and they were concerned for very good reason because this, of course, Article 4, Section 3, was adopted as part of the original seven articles of the Constitution in 1787 and ratified 1788-89. And it was adopted immediately after the tumultuous period of the 1780s, which is when we were operating under that predecessor, the Articles of Confederation.
Yes.
And what happened during the 1780s that made people concerned about creating states, especially states being created out of existing states? What happened?
Well, there were three states or three territories that created this concern. The first is the state of Vermont, which was broken out from the state of New York. The second was Kentucky, which ultimately came out of part of Virginia. And the third is the lost state of Franklin, which came out of North Carolina.
Ah, okay. Now, when we say it came out of those states, what that means is those states back in the 1780s were claiming territories that are no longer part of those states. Is that right?
That is correct.
I see. And in fact, in the case of North Carolina and Virginia, if I recall my history correctly, they were claiming pretty much all the way west to the Mississippi River.
They were. In the case of Kentucky, Virginia was willing to let Kentucky go, but in the state of the case of Franklin, North Carolina ceded the land to the U.S. government, and then with the proviso that it would be used to pay off debts for the war, and then the U.S. government had 2 years to do that. Well, the people that were in that land decided they wanted to form their own state, And then North Carolina took that land back, and so therefore you had two competing governments. You had this territory of Franklin that was trying to become a state.
Before we get into all of the complexity, what exactly are we talking about when we say the lost state of Franklin? Was that modern-day Tennessee?
It does encompass part of modern-day Tennessee, yes.
But only what part of it? Just the part right up there on the eastern edge, right?
Yeah.
What we now call East Tennessee, I think.
Yes, I believe so.
Okay. So there was an attempt in the 1780s to create several new states, and at least one of them, the state of Franklin, was proposed, where right now we would call East Tennessee.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, did the experiences of the 1780s impact then the drafting of Article 4, Section 3 in the Constitutional Convention?
We don't have a lot of information on the drafting of Article 4, Section 3, but if you take a close look at the Articles of Confederation, and then you compare how they admitted states with Article 4, Section 3 of the Constitution, you can see that there was a definite impact. And if you read some of the comments made by people such as Alexander Hamilton,
mm-hmm.
You can tell that it was very much on people's minds.
Okay. So the stuff that happened that we're going to be talking about in just a moment here, the mm-hmm. stuff that happened in East Tennessee in the 1780s had in all likelihood a direct impact on the people who got together at more or less the same time and held our Constitutional Convention in 1787 and specifically led them to require the consent of a state before a new state was formed out of that state's territory. All right. Anything else before we go on with our story?
I think that's it for now.
I think we've got it. Thank you for that excellent introduction. Next up, we're going to go directly to talk to Kevin Barksdale, a professor who literally wrote the book, The Lost State of Franklin, America's First Secession. Well, Dr. Kevin Barksdale, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, we're very happy to have you. You are the man who wrote the book on the lost state of Franklin. And so could you just tell us what it was?
Absolutely. Sort of in a nutshell, the state of Franklin was an effort by the political and economic leadership of what will eventually become East Tennessee to break away from their parent state of North Carolina. This happens immediately after the American Revolution, 1784, and declare themselves independent and form what would have been America's 14th state. They wanted to name it after Benjamin Franklin. That's where the term Franklin comes from, at least one of the origins. And from 1784 to 1788, they made a concerted effort to become America's 14th state.
So they had a four-year period where they actually sort of, kind of had their own state.
I think that's a fair characterization. I mean, it depends on what perspective you were coming from. The national government never recognized them, and the state of North Carolina, of course, never recognized them. But
Let me stop you there, Kevin, because, of course, I think some people are going to be a little bit curious. Why did the state of North Carolina think that it owned what is now Tennessee?
Sure. Well, you know, the original 13 colonies, especially colonies like Virginia and North Carolina, they had these expansive land claims, and in Virginia, North Carolina, in particular, believe they owned all of the land that stretched to the Mississippi River that sort of related to the kind of state, the colony and state boundaries. So, what is now Tennessee is what was part of North Carolina. What is now Kentucky was part of Virginia. Of course, Tennessee becomes a state in 1796. So. That was essentially it. I mean, North Carolina did own, you know, for lack of a better term, did claim ownership of what is now Tennessee.
Yeah, I think that's very interesting. If you look at maps from this period, from the 1780s, before we got much further, there were lots and lots of states that made claims that these states just stretched all the way to the Mississippi River.
And that's right. There's a wonderful T-shirt that they sell at the Virginia Historical Society in Richmond, Virginia. That has a a kind of a map of North America, and it has a kind of a large expansive cone, and the title at the top is something along the lines of when all the world was Virginia. So that's kind of how North Carolina looked at what would become Tennessee.
Sure, and that was a huge issue, and in fact it was a huge issue not just for the states involved, but it was a huge issue for a lot of other states, especially those up in New England and the Mid-Atlantic, who were really sort of confined by geography and by other state boundaries to the seaboard. They were rather concerned that these other states would just grow so large they would eventually overwhelm the Republic.
That's exactly right.
And so
you have concerns on the other end that if you have these larger states beginning to split up and splinter, that you would have you have a lot of comparisons to what was happening in what had happened in Switzerland, where you have these sort of hundreds of cantons, so you'd have hundreds of possible states, which could have produced probably more political confusion. So you see arguments on both sides of that.
Sure, and lots of politics on all sides. And of course, the Constitution itself, as we've already discussed, has a lot to say about admission of new states and about the idea of carving up existing states into smaller states and all that. So North Carolina had a lot to say about this, both politically and constitutionally, as did, of course, the other states in the Union. So that's the constitutional context in which this the circumstance arose. So why don't you again go? Let's take us back to the early 1780s and tell us about these people and what they did in the state of Franklin.
Sure, I think maybe logically, sort of the motivation for, and we'll refer to the leaders of Franklin, or I'll refer to the leaders of Franklin as the Franklinites. I like the way that sounds, but
I have to interrupt you again, Kevin. I have to interrupt you. What did Ben Franklin think about this? I mean, he was still alive then. He was alive for another several years. Was he encouraging this? Was he wanting a state named after himself?
It's an interesting question. You have two letters written. That originate out of the state of Franklin, written to Ben Franklin, in which they, these political leaders. One of them, I believe, is John Sevier. The other author is William Cock. And essentially, they write Franklin these letters, and this is during the period when they're fishing for prominent national figures to support their effort to create a state. So they write to Jefferson and Madison and Franklin, of course, is a logical person to write to, and he is flattered. He says, "I'm flattered by this," but he really can't countenance what they're doing and the kind of unorganized way that this process is moving forward. He also has some things to say about how they treated the Native Americans, the Cherokee. He's very unhappy with how the Franklinites, not just the Franklinites, but a lot of Western political leaders are negotiating land deals with the Native Americans. So Ben Franklin was flattered by the kind of nomenclatural tribute, but he wasn't supportive. And I think if he would have thrown his support behind the Franklin statehood movement, he may have pushed it over the top. I mean, it was much closer to becoming a reality than many people believe. So.
Yeah, but he's a smart guy, and he had to realize that if he was going to put his name on something or allow his name to be put on something, he'd be in for a penny, in for a pound. And so I think he was probably being careful in that regard. And I have to say one other thing just to clarify.
Sure.
Yet our Constitution says a lot about admission of states and dividing up states, but of course we're talking about a period before our current Constitution was in effect.
That's exactly right, and that's a...
Okay, so we're still operating under the Articles of Confederation, but
which provides very little guidance on
right.
this, and that is the major constitutional influence out of the state of Franklin. I mean, when they're drafting the language, which ultimately becomes what Article 4, Section 3, which is the most important part of the Constitution dealing with the creation of states out of pre-existing states, it's the Franklin statehood movement, as well as the Vermont statehood effort, all is occurring at the same time. And even in Virginia's Kentucky district, there's an effort to create a state. So the sort of architects of the current Constitution, United States Constitution, or the modern frame of government, they are absolutely drafting this legislation while thinking about the politics that are occurring in what is now East Tennessee and the violence surrounding Franklin. The political anarchy, the political chaos surrounding Franklin is a major reason why you end up with very specific guidelines for the dividing a pre-existing state and creating two states or even more. So
okay, so the primary constitutional significance of the lost state of Franklin is that it affected how the members of the Constitutional Convention addressed the issue of creating new states.
That's exactly right.
Because it happened before our current Constitution. Okay, I'm glad I clarified that, but I did interrupt your tale. So who were these people and what were they doing? I keep trying to get you to tell stories, and then I keep interrupting you. So please go on.
No problem. Well, so the origins, the motivations for this. So what would have motivated these North Carolinians, now East Tennesseans, to declare themselves independent from North Carolina and to launch this statehood effort? And I think this is going to be these motivations are still very relevant and prevalent in East Tennessee and Tennessee state politics. And essentially, the residents of the state of Franklin, and you're talking at the time Washington, Sullivan, and Greene counties, those are the four western counties across the Appalachian Mountains, they feel like they're being politically marginalized by the North Carolina state government, which is east of the Appalachians, and it's bouncing around. The capital bounces around a good bit, Hillsboro and Fayetteville, and they move around a little bit. But essentially, they feel politically marginalized, and they're unhappy with the political direction that North Carolina has taken them regarding land speculation, land claims, which is a major motivation for the Franklin statehood movement, as well as Native American negotiations. In this case, we're talking about the Cherokee, specifically the Overhill Cherokee. They're very unhappy with how the national government and the North Carolina government, they're much more willing to negotiate, and the leaders of the state of Franklin pretty much want to drive the Cherokee out of East Tennessee, the Upper Tennessee Valley. And so essentially they want to control their political future. They want to control these issues of land, the issue of economic development, the issue of Native American diplomacy. So they take an opportunity. After the American Revolution, the national government, as well as most of the state governments, are in terrible financial shape. I mean, the American Revolution had a catastrophic impact on the North American economy. And one of the ways they look at a sort of escaping this financial crisis is by forcing states like Virginia, like North Carolina, to either give up their western land or to pay a severe tax on this western land. So after the Revolution, states like Virginia, Georgia gives up land, New York gives up land. They essentially turn land over to the federal government and said, look, we don't want to pay taxes on it. You can sell it and use the revenue to lift the national government out of debt, pay off foreign debt, you know, basically to finance the Revolution. So,
and that's pretty much how the Northwest Territory was formed, right?
That's basically right. I mean, it's the same kind of idea. Happened a little later, obviously, but yeah, exactly right.
Mm-hmm.
And North Carolina gets on board a little late, but eventually they decide in 1784, after some debate, that they're going to cede their western land, which would be basically the entire state of Tennessee. They're going to cede it to the federal government, and they do. And there's some kind of underhanded shenanigans sort of behind the scenes being played by the leaders of the state of Franklin. They essentially convince a lot of eastern North Carolinians that it's in their interest to give this land up. And as soon as they pass what they call the Secession Act of 1784, which is the North Carolina legislation that turns the land over to the federal government, as soon as the legislation is passed, the leaders of the state of Franklin begin to basically cry, look, we've been abandoned by our parent state. North Carolina's cast us to the savages, which is essentially they're no longer protecting us from the Cherokee. And so they use this as a kind of a false pretext to declare themselves independent. They very quickly meet in Jonesboro, Tennessee, the oldest city in Tennessee,
I should interject. I'm sitting right down the street from there. I'm sitting in a studio in Johnson City, Tennessee, and we're just right down the road from Jonesboro. So I guess I'll have to make a trip over there soon.
You should. It's a wonderful community. They've done amazing historical preservation there. The people in Heritage Alliance and the people that have been involved in it have done a great job with Jonesboro.
Well, I'll have to do that anyway. That's what was going. This is where this is all headquartered. Then okay.
That's exactly right. So they meet in Jonesboro, and they haven't decided on what they're going to call this state, and there's some debate over whether or not they should actually take this step and declare themselves independent and try to form a new state. But eventually they decide they'll do that. And when the state of North Carolina and the political leadership in eastern North Carolina get word of what exactly has happened, they become angry and they feel like they've been duped. I mean, they had been duped, and they rescind the Session Act of 1784, which causes a whole kind of crisis in itself. But eventually, they try to take back North Carolina. They try to take back East Tennessee. And that immediately starts the relationship between what will become the Franklinites and the parent state of North Carolina and their government. This is under Governor Alexander Martin at the time. It creates a contentious relationship. And from that point forward, the political leadership of the Upper Tennessee Valley moved forward as though they've got a mandate from the national government. They've got a mandate from their constituency, and they begin to really promote the creation of an independent state, and they immediately name it, initially they name it Frankland, F-R-A-N-K-L-A-N-D, which is a kind of a nod to the Franks, the free land. And then they decide, and there's no evidence of why they do this, but then they change it to Franklin, after Ben Franklin. It's obviously a PR move to sort of attach your state to the most prominent, one of the most, if not the most prominent American sort of patriot at the time. And then the process begins.
We're talking to Professor Kevin T. Barksdale of Marshall University, who wrote the book The Lost State of Franklin, America's First Secession. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll come back and talk some more to Professor Barksdale. Stay tuned.
They couldn't pick a better time to start in life.
It ain't too early and it ain't too late.
Starting as a farmer with a brand new wife.
Soon be living in a brand new state.
Brand new state, gonna treat you great.
Gonna give you barley, carrots and potatoes.
Pasture for the cattle,
spinach and tomatoes.
Once again, it's time for the constitutional quiz, and we're waiting with bated breath for the quiz lady, Kelly Carmichael, the inquisitor extraordinaire, to come and stump us. Kelly, are you there?
Inquisitor extraordinaire, I like it. I'm going to add that one to my resume, I think.
Tremendous. It's a great title, isn't it?
It is.
Do you have a really tough question for us today?
I do. It'll be a short one, but I think it's a good one. It gets at some good principles of the Constitution.
Well, that's just great. Well, also with us today is our contestant, Adam, from where? From Fort Lauderdale?
Fort Lauderdale, Florida.
Tremendous.
Hi, Adam. How are you?
Wonderful. How about yourself?
Good. You ready for a tough one?
Possibly.
just remember, the stakes are high, because only if you answer correctly will you get your T-shirt emblazoned with your weekly constitutional. So play well.
Will do.
Okay.
Okay, so are we ready for the question?
Ready.
Okay. Here's the question, very short. A constitutional government is what? Is it A, unlimited power of the people, B, limited by a higher law, C, limited by a single ruler, or D, unlimited pursuit of happiness?
I like that last one.
I do
too. I'm bending towards that one, but I don't think that's the right one.
No, what it does, say the question again for the slower among us, including me.
Sure. The question is, what is a constitutional government? Is it A, unlimited power of the people, B, limited by a higher law, C, limited by a single ruler, or D, unlimited pursuit of happiness?
Adam, you're on your own here. I'm not going to help you out any.
I'm going to have to go with B as in boy.
B as in boy. What was that again?
The limited by a higher law.
Well, before we get to tell them whether that's correct or not, why didn't you like the other answer choices?
Why didn't you like unlimited pursuit of happiness?
Yeah.
I do, but that gets kind of hard to follow up with because we're not all happy.
I don't know, Adam. You sound pretty pessimistic to me.
I guess that's true.
I'm happy.
Yeah, I'm happy, too. I don't know about you. But
I'm pretty happy, but there's some unhappy people out there.
I guess that's true.
we need to change that.
We would have to call that a hedonistic government, I think.
Perhaps if everybody had a Your Weekly Constitutional t-shirt, they would be happy.
That's right. That's what we need to do. Okay, so you didn't like D because it was it didn't seem to apply. What about the other ones?
If you could repeat the first one again,
sure.
And third one?
The first one was unlimited power of the people.
Unlimited power of the people would be too vague and, I think, over broad in the sense that unlimited power of the people would let you do whatever you wanted to do, and I don't think the Constitution gives you the authority to do whatever you want to do.
Mm.
I think it's it limits both the government's action as well as people's actions.
Okay. What about C?
C was limited by a single ruler.
Yeah, we got rid of King George.
But we have a president, right?
That's true.
We do, but he's. Last time I checked, I don't think he can just rule from his bully pulpit.
I see. Okay, well, you know what? I think that Adam has reasoned this out fairly well, Kelly. I think I'm going to agree with him. I think B's probably the best answer. Is he right?
Adam, congratulations. You are going to spread happiness by wearing your Weekly Constitutional t-shirt.
Yay!
All right. I finally have some clothes.
Well, that prompts a really disturbing visual image here. I hope you're not sitting there naked taking the quiz. But, or shirtless, at least. But at any rate, we will get you a shirt. Okay.
Well, thank you very much. Enjoyed it.
Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, Adam.
Thank you.
We're talking about the mysterious, long-lost state of Franklin with Professor Kevin Barksdale of Marshall University. A little later on, I have a special treat for you, a field trip to the Tipton Haynes State Historic Site right here in Johnson City. But first, let's talk to Kevin Barksdale. I didn't even know that they had a constitution. They'd actually gotten that far. What was remarkable about it?
Well, the leaders of the state of Franklin were divided over one of the main reasons the state of Franklin collapses is because of the communities in the state of Franklin. There was a lot of political factionalism, and one of the reasons there was so much political factionalism is there was a debate over what the state's constitution should look like. What should this frame of government be? And on one side you have the more conservative group led by the only governor of Franklin, John Sevier, who of course will be the first governor of the state of Tennessee. And Sevier and his group want a conservative constitution that basically is more or less a knockoff of the North Carolina state constitution. But on the other end, you have a group led by Samuel Houston, Reverend Samuel Houston,
not the guy that went to Texas.
It's one of his relatives. I can't remember the relationship, but it will be one of his relatives, absolutely, who will be the Sam Houston of Texas independence fame.
Okay,
sure.
So there's a relation. I knew that Sam Houston, I think, had originally come from Tennessee, so this is part of the
right,
same family. Okay.
That's right.
All right.
And so Houston and a Presbyterian minister by the last name of Graham, I forget his name, Archibald Graham, I forget his first name right now, but they basically come up with a constitution that's pretty much known as the Houston-Graham Constitution. And what makes it so remarkable, there's several unusual things about it, but probably the most remarkable thing is just, you know, how much political power is dispersed among the sort of average resident. It is a very much an egalitarian constitution that, you know, there's nothing about property holding qualifications for voting. It's very democratic, and it's the kind of constitution that I think most Westerners would have wanted. It allowed a lot of localized political control, and it would have really undermined this sort of the entrenched political leadership of the Sevier group and others. It would have made it much more difficult for them to dominate the regional sort of political destiny of their community. So, and there's all kinds of other interesting things about this constitution. They do things like they more or less strip the ability of ministers and lawyers to hold political office, which was not all that uncommon, but still pretty remarkable. So what happens is they have a constitutional convention, and I think this is in 1786, and the debate is whether or not we just simply use the North Carolina Constitution as a blueprint, or do we embrace this Houston-Graham Constitution. And the Sevier faction wins, but it escalates into a pamphlet war,
It gets pretty nasty between these two factions, and it causes a number of people who supported Franklin to begin to, you know, sort of to begin to sort of separate themselves from the statehood movement, and it begins this process of increasing the anti-Franklin contingent. But that Constitution, you know, for your listeners, you can, if you want to, you know, go online and you do a, you know, a Google search, you can find the Houston Graham Constitution, and the Declaration of Rights that comes with it. It's a really a remarkable document.
Okay, but the severe faction won, and they got their conservative constitution, or their more traditional constitution, and then they set up their government. So what led it to fail?
Sure. Well, the state of the state of North Carolina has to decide how they want to deal with these this sort of, you know, renegade Franklin independence movement. And eventually, a new governor comes to power by the name of Richard Caswell. And Richard Caswell is an interesting figure. Richard Caswell was very good friends and business associates with the Franklin governor, John Sevier. He also had a huge stake in the Upper Tennessee Valley economy. He owned land, and so he didn't want the region to sort of plunge into, you know, violence and political chaos. He didn't want the regional economy to be disrupted. So what he decides upon is a strategy that I think may probably best described as a kind of a divide and conquer strategy. And what North Carolina basically does is they create a parallel state bureaucracy. So what you have in North Carolina from 1785, 86 to when Franklin collapses is you have a Franklin government and a North Carolina government existing at the same time in the communities of East Tennessee. So you have North Carolina courts and Franklin courts. You'll have a North Carolina sheriff, a Franklin sheriff. You'll have North Carolina elections and Franklin elections. And it creates a very sort of confusing situation. I mean, the residents of this region don't know who to pay their taxes to. Do we pay our state taxes to Franklin or North Carolina? A lot of people actually, just to be safe, when they get married, they'll get married in a North Carolina and a Franklin court. So you have this parallel bureaucracy, and that creates confusion. That kind of undermines the authority of the state of Franklin. And another thing Richard Caswell does with this sort of divide and conquer strategy is there very quickly emerges an anti-Franklinite faction, a faction that's loyal to North Carolina, who is very unhappy with John Sevier. A lot of these political rivalries predate this whole period, predate the Revolution. But the leader of this is a man by the name of John Tipton. If you're in Johnson City in East Tennessee, you've probably seen signs and maybe even have visited the Tipton Haynes House,
which was
John Tipton's farm. And so John Tipton and the so-called Tiptonites, so it's the Tiptonites versus the Franklinites, if you're keeping score at home, the Tiptonites and the Franklinites, the Tiptonites more or less begin to attract support over the life of Franklin, over the three and a half years of Franklin's existence, and the Caswell administration plays on that, and they offer support for the Tiptonites. They constantly offer to allow the Franklinites to sort of return their loyalties to North Carolina without penalty, and they all, you know, and even though they hadn't paid taxes for 2-3 years to North Carolina, they offered to forgive those taxes. So the strategy that Caswell and the North Carolina government deploys is to essentially try to confuse the population and then to support the sort of regional anti-Franklinites and to use this factionalism to more or less undercut the statehood movement from within. And that's essentially how they are able to defeat the statehood effort, and they believe they can do it without causing bloodshed, and they're wrong about that. But it could have been a lot worse.
How much bloodshed was there? What sort of blood was drawn here?
Sure. Now there's a lot of daily violence that doesn't result in loss of life, but one of the areas that you see a lot of violence between the Franklinites and Tiptonites are actually in the courthouses. There's a quip that one of the sheriffs makes back in 1787, where he says that people that attended the court sessions took lessons in pugilism. So they would basically, you know, they fought in the courtrooms, outside of the courtrooms. Of course, these you know, court days were, not only did they hold court there, but they were, you know, all kinds of business was conducted. They were, you know, there were almost celebrations back in the 18th century. So lots of people would come together, and there'd be lots of violence. And not just, you know, these are the most prominent civic leaders in this community that they would get in fights. The only known direct physical confrontation between John Sevier and John Tipton happened outside one of these courtrooms in Washington County, where I think Sevier hits Tipton with a cane, and Tipton punches John Sevier a few times, and they break him apart. So there's a lot of that kind of thing. There's a lot of, you know, Tiptonites would raid one of the Franklinite courtrooms and more or less throw the court out, you know, and they, so you have a lot of that. The real violence occurs in the winter of 1788 at the Tipton Haynes house, at that site. And that is actually the home of John Tipton. And what historians call the Battle of Franklin, and a lot of Tennesseans confuse that with the Civil War Battle of Franklin, but this Battle of Franklin essentially pitted between 200 and 300 Franklinite militiamen against 150 to 200 Tiptonite militiamen. And there are, you know, anywhere from 8 to 12 people killed, people wounded, and they basically, it's a two-day shootout in the snow at John Tipton's farm. And that's the majority of the violence, other than, and I guess I have to mention this, other than the fact that the state of Franklin, the Franklin militia, is basically constantly at war with the Overhill Cherokee. And the loss of life to the Overhill Cherokee caused by the state of Franklin is really catastrophic, to be frank about it. So So there's the Native American violence and bloodshed, there's the Battle of Franklin bloodshed, and then there's the kind of back and forth that goes on throughout the three and a half years of Franklin's existence. So it was, you know, it wasn't the Civil War, but it wasn't a particularly peaceful period of time either in the Upper Tennessee Valley.
Well, it sounds like a pretty hard time to live in this area, and that you're pretty much forced to choose sides, several different sides competing for influence and power here. Well,
that's right.
Dr. Kevin Barksdale, the time has passed all too quickly. What a fascinating subject, and I'm definitely going to get over to Jonesboro, and I'm going to take a visit over to the Tipton Haynes house, and I'm going to learn more about this because it's a fascinating subject, and as you pointed out, had enormous significance for the provisions of our current Constitution, which deal with the admission and the creation of new states, because we'd seen under the Articles of Confederation just how chaotic that process could be.
That's exactly right.
All right. Well, thank
you. I was just going to make sort of one more connection.
Absolutely. You have the last word.
Okay, great. Well, I currently teach at Marshall University in Huntington, West Virginia, and it's just some kind of twist of fate. The creation of the state of West Virginia during the Civil War relies very heavily on meeting the constitutional requirement that is laid out in that Article 4, Section 3, that is more or less, I think, is a direct, at least an indirect result of the Franklin statehood movement, when the state of West Virginia is applying to become what would be America's 35th state. They have to meet that requirement, and that major requirement is that the state of Virginia grants the state of West Virginia permission to create an independent state, and that's what happens during the Civil War. That requirement is met, and there's some debate about that as well, but that constitutional requirement is met in 1861, and so the state of Franklin in some ways is responsible for at least connected to the creation of the state of West Virginia, which creates some strange symmetry in my life. But
indeed it does. I'm going to suggest that next you take a faculty appointment in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, and perhaps you can help them form the long-discussed state of Superior. All right. Thank you very much, Dr. Kevin Barksdale. Appreciate your time.
Thank you very much.
After the break, we're going on a field trip to the Tipton Haynes State Historic Site in Johnson City, Tennessee.
Yeah, tip your hat to the Yankee conquerors. We got no ass under the bed. We're in the cups under our pillows with us. The state of America.
I really enjoyed my talk with Kevin Barksdale of Marshall University, but you know what? I also felt a little bit guilty, because for months now, I've been driving past all the signs that say, "This way to the Tipton Haynes State Historic Site in Johnson City," and like so many of you, I just drove on past. But when I spoke to Kevin and he told me how important that site was and the story of the lost state of Franklin, I decided the time had come for me to go there. And fortunately for me, I went on a day when I was able to speak to the director, the executive director of the entire site, Penny McLaughlin, who took me on a tour of the brand new State of Franklin exhibit.
The exhibit, as you can see, is right in the center of the of our permanent exhibit space. And we have things for everybody here with the State of Franklin. We have a 3 or 4 minute video which will orient people. It's a good beginning. For those who want to know a little bit more, we're going to have a chronology. And this will be year by year, really month by month. There are some people who really like to get to that level. Let me say also that everything in this exhibit, we have references for, if people want greater depth, then they can come to us and we'll have it available.
So this is not just a place for tourists, this is a place for scholars as well.
To learn,
to
right.
Learn,
and
right.
We have a library and we have an archive, so we can get you to where you need to go depending on what you may want to learn with the State of Franklin.
After I spoke to Penny, I spent a fair amount of time speaking to Wes Spurgeon, the resident expert on the State of Franklin at the Tipton Haynes Historic Site. Wes was telling me who exactly this Colonel Tipton was.
So Tipton is a North Carolina guy.
Yes.
He's a loyalist in that sense. Now, who was his great nemesis on the side of the State of Franklin?
His great nemesis was the State of Franklin governor, John Sevier.
Okay.
They had already begun butting heads by the time Colonel Tipton was living here in the State of Franklin was created, because Colonel Tipton actually attended the first several constitutional conventions for the State of Franklin. Him and his brother Jonathan Tipton did for Washington County, and they had voted against the State of Franklin.
Okay.
So parts of Washington County and a lot of Sullivan County were actually against the State of Franklin movement.
Okay, we're in Washington County now, right?
Yes.
And this was Washington County then as well?
Yes.
Okay.
Washington County and all three of those counties are actually larger than what they are today. Mm-hmm. A lot of the counties that we have today were actually created out of those. So you had more than what is today living in...
Okay, but this particular little part we're in right now was and remains of
Washington
County.
Yes.
Though, of course, it's now Washington County, Tennessee.
Yes.
All right, so that's what we got. We've got these two guys who are butting heads and raiding each other's courthouses mm-hmm. and burning records. Does it ever come to the physical violence beyond that? Actually people butting heads literally?
Well, we have two instances between Colonel Tipton and John Sevier where they actually do come to blows.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is in Jonesboro, which was the Washington County seat for the State of Franklin.
And that's right down the road here, just
right,
a few miles.
Right down the road. Mm-hmm. It was not the capital. Greenville was the capital of the State of Franklin. But one day, Colonel Tipton was in Jonesboro, and so was John Sevier. They actually saw each other on the streets, and it actually came to blows between the two before they were separated. And then in 1788, there was actually a battle fought on this site between Colonel Tipton and John Sevier.
A battle?
A battle. Well, it wasn't so much as a battle as a small skirmish.
Mm-hmm.
From February 27th to February 29th, it was a leap year that year, and it was a bitter cold winter in 1788. There was a brief siege and a brief skirmish.
Well, how did it begin? Who decided to attack whom?
Well, it all led up to, the reason why is John Sevier was not paying his taxes owed to North Carolina.
Okay.
And since Colonel Tipton was over...
I'm betting Colonel Tipton was not paying his State of Franklin taxes either.
No.
Okay, all right.
But there was a more loyalist for North Carolina than there was Franklinites.
Okay.
So since Colonel Tipton was over the North Carolina courts, he had his sheriff, Jonathan Pugh, who had been a family friend long before Tipton even arrived here in Tennessee, sent his sheriff, Pugh, to John Sevier's home down around Jonesboro. While John Sevier was out with his militia fighting the Cherokee Indians at the time, so Pugh took some property, mainly slaves of Sevier, and in retribution for not paying the taxes.
Okay. Well, that'll make anybody angry, is yes. taking property. Now, of course, unfortunately, it was slave property. That's a whole nother issue. But so he seized property for unpaid North Carolina taxes.
Yes, and he brought him to Colonel Tipton's property for safekeeping.
I see. So the property, the slaves, are here.
Here on Colonel Tipton's property. When John Sevier hears about this, he has the authority, being the state of Franklin governor, to raise the Franklin militia. And he does that. There's many sources that tell numbers of how many. There could have been between 100 to 150 Franklin militia men that joined Sevier. So Sevier comes to the edge of Colonel Tipton's property. He really did not want bloodshed in this. He basically wanted Tipton to turn over his property and basically to conform to the state of Franklin government. Well, Tipton didn't want that. He wanted Sevier to be arrested, and he wanted him to conform to the North Carolina government and forget about the whole state of Franklin affair. So there was flags of truce between each other. On February 27th, there was a small force coming to reinforce Tipton. They were shot at by John Sevier's men, killing some of their horses.
So Sevier's men fired the first shots at a group of Tipton reinforcements that were coming here.
Yes.
Okay, so the Franklinites started it. We can blame it on them, all right.
But there was a small group with Tipton in his cabin. We've heard estimates from 15 to 30 men. We're not for sure.
That would have pretty much filled up that cabin. That was not a particularly large cabin.
And then you also had Colonel Tipton, some of his sons were here helping him.
But let me interrupt here. I don't mean to interrupt the narrative, but where did he get the title Colonel? Was it during this battle or during this war, or was it something earlier?
Well, he was actually a colonel with the Revolutionary War up in Virginia.
Oh, okay, so this is a title he had when he came here.
He was also a colonel of the North Carolina Western armies.
Okay, so he was part of the North Carolina militia as well.
Yes.
Okay, so the colonel, who already had his title, has some of his men in his house, maybe 15, maybe 30 of them, and they're now shots have been fired. So what happened?
Well, they don't hear those shots because they're miles away. Mm-hmm. So they don't know about this until after the battle occurs. But there's a small group in his cabin that sneaks away during the first night and actually brings back reinforcements. So we don't know how many brought back on the first night. So he has some more reinforcements. And you still have flags of truce going between Tipton and Sevier. Neither side wants to give or take. And then finally, on February 29th, the third day, there's a large North Carolina Loyalist force coming from Solomon County. Well, there's a big blizzard going on that Sevier and his men does not even see this force of about 100 men. They reach Colonel Tipton in his cabin, and when they reach, either they, some sort of say, shot some fires, or some of the Franklinites shot at that reinforcement. Unfortunately, we do not know who shot the first shot on the third day, but after those shots are fired, Tipton and his men come running out of the cabin, and all of his reinforcements charge at John Sevier's men. And it happens in the field right over there.
We can look right out the window. We're sitting in one of the outbuildings on the house, on the property, the law office of a later owner, Haynes, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we're looking through the panes of glass out on a meadow, and that's where the charge occurred.
Yes, they charged out through there because Sevier and his men were camped out there.
Mm-hmm.
So they charged at Sevier's men, and the battle lasted only for 10 minutes. So it's not really much of a battle. A lot of the men didn't even have weapons with them. Mm-hmm. A lot of them shot up in the air, didn't want to kill nobody. So Sevier and his men retreated back to Jonesboro. Tipton captured a lot of Sevier's men, including some of his sons. And he also followed after Sevier to try to capture him. A flag of truce was sent from Sevier to Colonel Tipton saying, okay, let's end this here. I'll conform to North Carolina.
Well, Sevier was ready to surrender then.
Well, he lied.
Oh, well, he sent a flag of truce and he, oh my goodness. All right.
So Tipton stopped in his charge after Sevier and let him go, mm-hmm. Believing that Sevier would later conform to North Carolina, which he did not. But a few days later, Sevier was not the governor of the state of Franklin no more. His term ran out. Mm-hmm. It was a 3-year term. So for about another year, there was no governor of the state of Franklin.
I have to ask, did Tipton also release his other prisoners, including Sevier's sons?
Yes, he released the prisoners, even Sevier's sons. There's some sources that say that he wanted to hang them, but he did not.
He didn't do that. What about the property, the slaves? Did he release the slaves as well?
Unfortunately, we do not know about the slaves. Okay. There's one source that says that one of the male slaves actually escaped Tipton's property and actually made his way back to Sevier.
Interesting.
So that's the only record that we know of what happened to Sevier's property.
Okay. So, but within a few days after the battle, Tipton thinks that Sevier has surrendered and thinks that Sevier is now going to become a North Carolina loyalist.
Yes.
And then what happens?
Well, there's an arrest warrant sent from the North Carolina governor, sent over here to Colonel Tipton and all the North Carolina courts to arrest Sevier. So Tipton, gladly enough, goes out and actually arrests John Sevier, sends him to North Carolina.
Because by this time he realizes that Sevier's been fibbing to him.
Yes.
Okay.
But there was no trial because some of his friends and family members came and actually helped him escape from the North Carolina court. But in early 1789, the State of Franklin movement has just been lost. They know they're not going to be recognized by the U.S. government. So they basically give up, and John Sevier and several State of Franklin officials basically take an oath of allegiance to North Carolina.
And they were granted clemency?
They were.
Okay.
That same year, John Sevier was actually elected to become a North Carolina legislature.
Isn't that interesting?
Yes. So he helped, that same year, he also helped North Carolina ratify the U.S. Constitution, and he also helped North Carolina cede its western lands again. And this time, the United States remembers the State of Franklin movement and quickly steps in and acts and creates the Southwest Territory.
Isn't that interesting? And if I remember my history correctly, then Sevier went on to greater things in the state of Tennessee, didn't he?
He became the first governor of Tennessee.
Well, isn't that interesting now? So Sevier lost the battle, and the State of Franklin collapsed.
Yes.
But he himself rose rather phoenix-like from the ashes. Yes. And was instrumental in North Carolina politics, in the ratification of the federal constitution, mm-hmm. and the creation of the state of Tennessee, and was so well thought of that he then became the first governor of the state.
Yes.
Wow, Tipton must not have been very happy.
Well, oddly enough, Tipton became a part of helping create the state of Tennessee as well.
Did the two of them become buds then?
We're not for sure.
We're not for sure.
Because okay. Colonel Tipton was involved in some of the first assemblies for Tennessee.
Right.
And he also helped write the first state constitution. So they did deal with each other down the road, but we're not for sure if they later became buds or not.
But at the very least, they were no longer engaging in fisticuffs, and they were no longer fighting pitched battles against each other.
Yes.
Well, then I guess it's a happy ending.
I believe so.
All right. Well, Wes, thank you very much for that fascinating account of what happened here at the Tipton-Haynes house. We know that there's more history, of course. History didn't stop with the state of Franklin, but mm-hmm. that is the focus of our show today, so maybe we'll have to come back and talk to you some other time about some of the Confederate stuff that happened here.
We'll be glad to have you.
Thanks, Wes.
I really want to thank Wes Spurgeon and Penny McLaughlin of the Tipton-Haynes State Historic Site. That was a great visit, and this has been a fascinating topic, hasn't it? We've talked a lot today about the lost state of Franklin and its role in our constitutional history, but in the short time remaining to us, I'd like to talk just a little bit more to my student, Brad Blanchard, and I'd like to ask you, Brad, other than the state of Franklin, have there been any controversial creations of new states in our history?
Oh, there have been plenty of them. Vermont springs to mind with New York.
Vermont? Uh-huh. Vermont is such a laid-back place. I mean, they were controversial.
They were controversial, and they were looking for statehood for a long time.
And New York thought they were part of New York?
And New York thought they were part of New York.
What about New Hampshire? Did New Hampshire have a claim there, too?
New Hampshire did have a claim. Vermont basically said that New York had achieved its charter from the crown, and when America tried to break away, that negated the crown grant of land, and therefore Vermont was entitled to form its own state.
And it did.
And it did.
Wow.
In addition to Vermont, you also have West Virginia.
Oh, which is, there's a big one.
Which is huge. And then...
Well, West Virginia, before we have just a minute on that. Now, West Virginia was actually born out of a secession from the Commonwealth of Virginia during the heat of the Civil War, wasn't it?
Yes, and there's a lot of controversy as to whether or not their breakaway was constitutional. And it was argued for 2 days in the Senate as well as 2 days in the Congress before it went up for a vote. And even after that point in time, President Lincoln asked his cabinet to give him their opinions, and they split 3-3 down the middle as to whether or not it was constitutional. And then he issued his own statement on whether or not it was constitutional.
Did West Virginia at least try to follow the dictates of Article 4, Section 3 of the Constitution?
They did. They followed them all to the letter. As in fact, some people have claimed that their some people have claimed that it was hyper-technical, that they followed all of the points of the letter of the law, but they didn't follow the spirit of the law.
Yeah. I mean, we're going to have a whole episode on the creation of West Virginia at some point. That's just a great story in and of itself. Anything currently? Anything going on now with the creation of states?
Yes. Puerto Rico.
Puerto Rico. Yes. Is it going to be the 51st state or not?
You know what? That is up for debate. It's been a commonwealth since 1951. They have held referendums on statehood before. In their last referendum, 50% of the people in Puerto Rico voted for none of the above. But 46.5% voted for statehood. Every time they hold these referendums, the number going for statehood seems to increase. And there's a bill making its way through the House of Representatives right now. It's 2499. And it's a non-binding referendum, but basically it would make the people of Puerto Rico vote, and it would be a two-step process. First, they would vote to decide whether they want to keep their current status or they want to do something different. And then if they decide they want to do something different, then there would be a second vote where they'd either have to vote for statehood or independence or whether they wanted sovereignty in association with the United States.
So we've got at least one vote coming up among the good people of Puerto Rico.
Mm-hmm.
Possibly two votes coming up over the next couple of years. And then, of course, whatever they vote would have to be approved by the U.S. Congress pursuant to Article 4, Section 3 of the Constitution.
Yes. It's likely, though, that the Congress would not turn them down, seeing as how they already have one representative in Congress, even though that representative cannot vote.
Well, it's an endlessly fascinating topic, this creation of new states, a topic that is still with us today. But sadly, we're out of time to talk about it. So once again, I must bid a fond farewell to all of you out there in Radio Land. I've got to thank my executive producer, Wayne Winkler. I've got to thank my guest, Penny McLaughlin, and Wes Spurgeon of the Tipton Haynes State Historic Site. And of course, a big thank you to Kevin Barksdale, an assistant professor of history at Marshall University in West Virginia. I'd also like to thank my student, Brad Blanchard of the Appalachian School of Law. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, it's your Constitution, and by golly, you need to learn it.